the processes. And the pressure began to build to control some of this from a more central place, to stop communities, for example, from incorporating and gobbling up everything around them, including farmland and desert, and just swallowing it all up with low-density housing, which is tremendously, tremendously costly because you've got to run and maintain utility lines to all those places, and very often that's a municipal function. Other places were being fundamentally taken over by huge developers who were only building the kind of stuff that they were expert at or could make the most profit at, and so they were developing all retail towns or all mansion towns or all apartment towns with no jobs around, etc. So sometime around mid-century, a movement began to at least pass some minimal rules on the state level so that communities would have to be a bit beholden to each other. Under Governor Jerry Brown, who observed that a lot of the people who were coming to California were bringing their bad habits with them, and that we were beginning to replicate the kind of segregated conditions on the East Coast, he put together a group to ask what to do about housing, and they recommended that a housing element be added to the circulation element and the health and safety and the other elements, and that communities be required to turn in one of those every few years as well. And ever since then, communities have been required to do so, and to meet certain standards that are in the state planning and zoning law, as well as its civil rights law and its Fair Housing Act. And about a third of the communities either don't do it, or they don't do it in a timely fashion, or they do it in a manner that's nasty enough that their housing elements are rejected by the state. There isn't a lot of enforcement mechanism for that. A couple attempts to really enforce that in the state legislature in the last few years have failed, but there are some punishments for not doing so, for not turning in a housing element which gains what they call certification from the state housing and community development. And one of them is that specialized funds, disaster funds, home funds, and let me see, Community Block Development Grant
Fund. CDBG fund.
You got it. They get cut off if a community doesn't have a certified housing element. Now, you mentioned ignoring the task for the last decade. There are two jurisdictions that often get confused in people's minds because they have nearly identical names, and that's the City of Santa Cruz and the County of Santa Cruz. The city has, to my knowledge, at least ever since I've been in this area, which is since 1978, the city has always had a certified housing element. They weren't necessarily the most creative or ambitious housing elements, but they've always stayed within state law, and thus they've always ended up getting the funding, and they've used the funding fairly well. The county of Santa Cruz, the last time its housing element was in compliance enough to be certified was the 1985 housing element. It failed to get certification for its 94 element. 1994, it made a deal with the state that gained it provisional certification in 1999, and then the Board of Supervisors turned down the deal. So it is now in its ninth year, the county is, of not having a certified element and of losing disaster relief funds, home funds, and community block grant development funds. But the city has pretty much stayed in conformity. And the city works harder to do that.
Where does most of the money go? Does it go mostly to the county or to the city? What are they, do you know how much in funds each of these groups is available for getting?
It varies all the time. I know that the county has lost an estimated, it has lost up to an estimated $30 to $40 million. Just from the home and community block grant development funds, because it has not been in compliance, because fundamentally it's refused to come into compliance with state law. Now that 30 to 40 million, that's 3 to 4 million a year, or a little more if you count the disaster funds, is not guaranteed to the city or to the county. It would have had to compete for that money. However, given the sophistication of administrators around here who tend to be very good at writing grants and very good with language. Santa Cruz County previously had a very good history of getting that kind of money. The city has continued to get that money, has applied for it, and has gotten it on a fairly regular basis, as well as getting special funds. For example, the city applied under a state anti-pollution grant to fund the loan program for ADUs, for second units, granny units, which give a guarantee of affordability for some certain period of time. And it wrote the grant in such a way that it got those funds easily. Those are the kinds of things, many of those kinds of funding streams, the county has not been able to get because of its refusal to cooperate with the state. The city has been able to get them.
Now, what's been the point of dispute between the county and the state?
Fundamentally, the county refuses to zone unbuilt land for anyone but the wealthiest of people. That's the root of the dispute. I think that you and I have probably observed that if you hold location and amenities constant, and in a small area that's fairly easy to do, rent is a function of square footage, right? There's nowhere in the world where a small second unit in back of a house, for example, rents for more than the house itself. And in higher land cost areas, and that's about half or even now two-thirds of the industrialized world, square footage is a function of density. A building on a high land cost area is going to be the same size because the cost of paying off the land is so high. The question is how many units can people divide a building into? When you limit density, when, for example, you say, well, you can only build 5 units per acre, what you end up with is a building that, instead of having 100 apartments in it, will have, for example, 5 units, which are going to end up being condominiums, which are going to only go to the very high end of the population. And what the county has done is limit density so severely that the only housing that the private market can build in the county is extremely low density housing, which therefore the units are large in size and therefore rent for a lot or sell for a lot and therefore go to the wealthy. And the state has been trying to convince the county. That's the first thing. The second thing is the incredible number of restrictions it places on building anything. And so the state has been gently coaxing the county to allow more to be built for moderate income and low income, at least moderate income and low income people. Because what happens is that in an area like Santa Cruz, where there's a lot of in-migration from wealthy people, if they cannot find the kind of fancier units they're looking for, they start buying and renting down. And so, for example, wealthy people will begin to occupy moderate-sized housing. Moderate-income people will start to occupy low-income people's what normally be low-income people's housing. Low-income people are forced into very low-income, very low-income and into extremely low-income, and therefore those whose incomes are the most changeable and fragile end up being homeless. You know, the entire market works together, the entire private market. And so the state has been just after and after and after the county to allow a wider range of housing so that eventually, hopefully, at least nearly everyone can be housed.
Are you saying this hasn't been a problem in the city?
It has been a problem in the city, but the city has been a lot more cooperative about it. The city is more built out than the county is, and so the state understands that the city doesn't have as much room to move. And the city has been far more creative about this than the county has. Really, the most crucial thing in terms of stopping this fall into homelessness of families, which I'm sure, as you know, is the newest group to suffer from on a mass basis from this phenomenon, is to get units in the very and extremely low income categories built. Now, units in the very, very low income, at least the top half of very low income, can easily be built by the private market. Units for the extremely low income people usually need to be built with subsidy or with public-private partnerships.
Can you clarify for folks who don't know what these different categories actually cover? Extremely low, low, very low.
Okay, sure. Sure. There are, well, let's start at the top. Above moderate is, that's people who earn from 120% of median income and above. And median income for a family of four in this area, believe it or not, was just measured to rise again to about $74,000 a year. It's different for an individual. It's less. It's 40-something, but it's $74,000, $75,000. That's median. Moderate income is from 80 to 120% of that. Low income is from 50 to 80% of that, depending, and there are several different measures. I always get confused. HUD uses one set of measures, and low-income housing advocates use another, and the state uses one that varies sometimes in some categories from that. But in general, low income is, I think it is 60% of median, up to median. Very low income, 30%, extremely low income below that, the very bottom of the income range. And one thing that Paul Brindell at the Community Action Board has pointed out is that some 19% of extremely low income people have in the lowest income, you know, quintile, have experienced homelessness at least temporarily within the last few years. And so we're beginning to experience a spread of at least temporary homelessness among extremely low-income families. Now, one thing you asked me about, the difference between the city and county, one difference, for example, is in the ADU, in the second unit thing. And this is important because the population, the American population, which used to be some 30% single people, is now some 40% single people, as seniors are living longer and as people delay marriage more for longer periods of time. And so if one fails, you know, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the whole market works together. If one fails to accommodate people who are single, then they gather together in groups and occupy the starter homes that used to be occupied by poorer families. And so the city, for example, has progressively loosened and loosened and loosened its rules for second units to get more and more built. And sure enough, since 1994, when it began loosening the rules, and it just did so twice again in the last year, production of second units at first tripled and is now nearly 10 times what it was per year that it was before 1994. Compare that to the county, which has tightened and tightened and tightened the rules. They were ordered by the state, as all communities were under AB 1866, to loosen them to some degree, but they tried to balance that with tightening them yet some more, restricting yet more the kinds of lots and the places and the regulations with which they could be built. As a result, the county has had absolutely no increase in production. And so here we have this large landmass in the county in which the number of ADUs is not increasing even as the population increases and as the number of single people are growing, which means that more of the starter homes are occupied by groups of students, groups of seniors, etc., versus the city where the number of ADUs is growing tremendously. And that's one reason why rents are falling in the city, is because the city's done stuff like that. Another example is the treatment of SROs. As you know, SROs are really important to extremely low-income people.
Now, we're talking with Paul Wagner, who's actually one of the 16 people on the task force. What's the name of the task force you're on, Paul?
Uh-huh.
What's the name of that task force?
Housing Advisory Committee.
The Housing Advisory Committee. This is city or county?
City.
You're talking about ADUs, which are accessory dwelling units, and SROs, which are single room occupancy, for those who are naive and new to these matters.
Right, like the St. George.
The former St. George.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And SROs are also really important. And they're especially important shelter to those of extremely low income who might be transitory, or who might only have income, let's say, a few months a year, that allows them to not have to double up or triple up or quadruple up with other people. The county has promised in its last several housing elements that it would pass an SRO ordinance, giving the conditions under which SROs could be built, because they can't be built under the county's zoning, because it's restricted to a maximum of 17 units an acre. And obviously, nobody's going to buy an acre of land and put in 17 SRO units and leave the whole rest green space. No. The city, on the other hand, has repeatedly revised its SRO ordinance until we see hundreds and hundreds of SRO units going up. I'm sure you're familiar with some of those. One is next to Woodstove and Sun on Soquel Drive. Another is the Branson 40 Creek project that's going up. So pretty much...
How many units in the last decade have been... How many SROs have been built in the city?
In the city?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. In the last decade. Are we including the replacement of the post-earthquake?
Sure.
Well, we managed to defeat... Back when I was on the Housing Advisory Committee last time it was active, we managed to defeat a plan by some well-known county people to limit the number of rooms, so we got the St. George rebuilt to the degree it's been rebuilt, got an expansion of the Palomar. That alone is a few hundred units. I don't know how many of them are technically SROs, Robert, but the city has between 600 and 700 units that have begun or completed construction in the last 3 years, and the majority of those are SROs.
And since we estimate 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people in the city, how would you estimate the deficiency in the number of SROs that should be available that aren't?
Well, I would say that we could easily double or triple the number of SRO rooms. Now, of course, all of those, not necessarily all of those are going to go to city residents, but we could easily double or triple those. And given the income patterns that I've seen, both personally and I say that because back years ago I was temporarily homeless several times, and the ones I read about from the Community Action Board and other sources, I would say that some of those also would need to be subsidized SROs. Some of them would need to be below market rents for people who are homeless to be able to afford them and hang on to them while they make the transition back into, you know, employment or into getting permanent assistance.
I mean, it's some of those wonderful, like, $8 an hour jobs you can get downtown on Pacific Avenue.
Yes, if you can subsidize the rents heavily enough, then people can work $8 an hour jobs, you know, entry level jobs, and still afford those places and hang on to them without too much fear. It tends to be very difficult to do that with market rate SROs. Those tend to be more for the people who are earning $10 to $12 to $14 an hour. But the city is still short. But the city, again, is, in terms of ADUs, in terms of SROs, in terms of other small units, both subsidized and unsubsidized, doing a spectacular job compared to the county. I think an example of this, Robert, would be the double 1010 Pacific and Schaefer Road projects, which the developer came forward with and said, we can produce 40% affordable, guaranteed for 55 years, in other words, way under market rate rents, for low and very low income people if you will waive the fees. And both of these projects demanded tremendous number of variances, especially out on Schaefer Road, which is low density, and the city, which without much hoopla, simply granted the fee waivers.
How many units are we talking about were actually, I guess, no extremely low income, right? Just very low income?
I don't think there were any extremely low. Extremely low is used by HUD, you know, the housing and urban development, the federal government, and it's also used by local housing advocates it tends not to be used by the state of California, that category.
What percentage of the units were either low income?
40% are low or very low.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a total between the two projects, there are a total of 200 units, so we're looking at 80 units.
Okay. Now, you mentioned ADUs.
Uh-huh.
You and I have had this conversation many a time, and you've been talking about how you have to proceed, perhaps as Emily Riley might put it, with baby steps, in order to, first of all, make it legal to build ADUs, make it more likely that they're going to be built.
Right.
I've been pointed out that there are thousands of ADUs that should be amnestied or grandfathered in, and that never seems to make it past the Kennedy-Rotkin barrier. I don't know. What's going on with that?
Well, I think you've misidentified the barrier. Scott and Mike are actually two of the people who most like the idea of amnesty. They tend, however, to be most open-mouthed about the fact that the time at which the specific times in which the rules are being loosened to make them more legal don't tend to be the times when it's best to propose the amnesty. And the reason for that, may I give my theory as to why?
Sure, although let me point out that these individuals have been on the council Rotkin's been on the council on and off for decades, Kennedy
mm-hmm.
for the last decade,
uh-huh.
on and off. And I don't recall, but maybe you can tell me, has he ever, about either of these two, ever actually publicly proposed these amnesties and introduced legislation to that effect?
They tend to be proposed in a different way, Robert. They don't tend to be proposed as straight amnesty. The way they tend to be proposed as is permitting the planning department to revisit its rules with an eye toward bringing illegal units into safety, health and safety conformity. And the city is actually a lot looser about this than it used to be. It hasn't been done on a formal basis because the city has revised its ADU ordinances so often. And this brings out the NIMBY people. And so instead, what they tend to do it is by administrative rather than by ordinance. And the council resolution or whatever will simply instruct the planning department to go ahead and make whatever changes to its rules it needs to.
Are you suggesting that ADUs previously considered illegal are now administratively considered legal to the extent, for example, to which an individual living in one could actually file a complaint about a health and safety violation without getting his ass kicked out?
No. The way they do operate, however, is that a landlord, for example, two of whose neighbors have informed them that they're really starting to get annoyed at the way things are going, can now step forward and go to the city and say to them, I have an ADU which I did not understand was illegal. I was told by the realtor when I was sold the place that it was legal. I'd like to legalize it. And the chances are better and better every year that they can do so.
Well,
and the moment it is legal, of course, then the tenants have rights.
Well, how many have been legalized in the last decade?
I don't know the answer. I heard the answer from Gene Arner, the planning director, but I don't remember what it is. It's at least several dozen.
Compared with hundreds? Or how many are thousands of units
probably
out there?
The planning department estimated the first year I moved to Santa Cruz, which was 1978, that there were 1,500 illegal units at the time. They're now estimating there are 2,000 or so.
So several dozen out of 2,000 is a good record as far as you're concerned?
Oh, no. No, I don't. I don't like this whole thing with tenants not having rights. I don't like it one single bit. If I were on the council, I would really push for amnesty. On the other hand, I do understand that every time that the ADU rules get loosened, whole bunches of people come forward and protest that and threaten to sue, as Barney Elders did, who actually filed a suit against the city, and therefore that it's usually good to wait until some new legal ADUs are built, let the neighbors experience the fact that they're not causing problems and then come up with the amnesty. And so that's fundamentally what the city has done, is it has created amnesty bit by bit, not nearly enough, but it's created amnesty bit by bit when owners come forth. I personally think more needs to be done.
Well, it sounds like it's been minuscule. I mean, a dozen units next, or two dozen units next to the 2,000 units that exist is not just a drop in the bucket, it's a drop in the bucket.
Well, there's also the fact that one cannot really force people into seeking amnesty. A lot of people on the council feel, from experiences that other communities have who have had amnesty programs, that you also get a minuscule number of people stepping forward, because after all, right now, they're able to collect the rents, et cetera, without having to do any code improvements, without having to sprinkler the units, which is a tremendously expensive process. It can be up to $9,000 just to dig the trenches and bring the pipes, separate pipes, back to sprinkler. It's very difficult to get people to step forth with the units, you see. And so even if you do have an amnesty program, very often 1 or 2% of the people will come forward.
Well, let me ask you about other communities. You probably in the course of your analysis and work with this issue, are there other communities in California which have had more massive amnesty programs that were either successful or unsuccessful?
There is none that I know of that has had an amnesty program that's been massively successful. There's just too much that both landlords and tenants get out of not rocking the boat for people to come forward.
What communities have had amnesty programs that are significantly bigger than Santa Cruz?
I can't name any for you at this time. I mean, I have things on my hard drive. I have case studies and stuff from Southern California, but I don't remember which communities they are right now.
Expecting a full report when next we meet. We're talking with Paul Wagner. Paul, I know you're suffering this morning from a cold. I tried to coax you to coming into the studio, and you also have commitments this afternoon. I want to invite people to email in questions, because this phone line is being taken up at rnorse2@hotmail.com for Paul Wagner, again, who's on the Housing Advisory Committee. Is that?
Yes, that's the name of it, yep.
I also have a suggestion, Paul, if you can, how's your energy holding out? How much?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I can talk about this stuff forever.
Well, maybe what we could do is, I could take a chance to take a breather, have a walk, stretch, and maybe call back in about 10 or 15 minutes, give some other folks a chance to call in and ask a few questions. Maybe you can hear your radio from where you are.
I will gladly do that. Why don't I call you back at noon?
Okay, what I'm wondering is, can you hear people's questions as they come in? Because that's how you might be able to get some kind of feedback.
Okay, I've been deliberately staying away from my radio so that we don't get the echo. Let me turn on my radio here.
If you are in Santa Cruz, it's 96.3. If you are south of Santa Cruz, it's 101.1. If you're outside the area, it's www.freakradio.org. And you're tuned to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris, and on the line with me is Paul Wagner. So, Paul, why don't we do that? Why don't we give you a little time to... I mean, you don't have to make it so long a period of time. I mean, I'm just thinking giving people an interval to call in. If they choose not to, I'd love to continue this conversation, and because I think we're covering a lot of interesting territory here.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, let me see here. I'm looking for 96.3. Let me see if I get it in here. Some days I do, some days I don't.
Okay, let's see if you can actually hear the infamous 96.
Nope.
Can't hear it, eh?
No, let me try
101.1.
I'm doing that right now.
We're going to 101.1 here. This is Experiments in Progress on the air. Can you hear anything on that channel?
No.
Oh, dear. How about www.freakradio.org?
Okay, I can turn on my computer and try that.
All righty. Boy, we're just hitting batting zero here.
Just a second here. Let me see. Is my computer on? Yes, it's sleeping.
What's the impact of the university on this housing element while you're tuning?
On the housing element?
Well, the housing situation, I understand, is badly affected by the university's failure to provide the housing. I know that activist Michael Schmidt was always concerned about this when he was doing he was running for Board of Supervisors and working on homeless issues. He brought this issue to a couple of the meetings.
Sure.
What's your sense?
My sense is that the university has not met its stated commitment or its goal. It promised to house some... just a second, I'm typing in the freakradio.com.
.org. Remember, orgy might be one of the...
I'm sorry?
.org.
.org, that's it. Okay, just a sec. Ta-da! O-R-G. Let's see. Screw the FCC. Okay. Live stream. I'm hitting live stream. Listen live 64. High band. Okay. Let's try. Error.
Uh-oh.
Wait. Here it comes.
Freak radio.
Something is talking out of your machine there, Paul.
Okay. Let me turn this down so that... all right. The university promised to... in its long-range development plan to accommodate, to house on campus 70% of its bunch, its students, faculty, etc. They have never been able to do that. They began immediately trying to, and they've reached 45%, and they've stayed standard. They've stayed consistently at housing 45% of their population. So they have done a majority of what they said they would. But they haven't met their goal and haven't met their commitment.
And they continue to expand their student body massively, right?
Yes, but they continue to also stay up with their 45%, which means that there is an increase in the raw number. I have to say, Robert, though, that I'm pretty cynical about the, or at least skeptical about the claim that the university is the cause of our housing problems, because, first of all, we invited the university here. The city and county did. Second, at the time when the city and county invited the university, or at least the city invited the university, it did not pressure the city into any specific housing, any specific proportion or component of its population. To my knowledge, somebody might have different knowledge than that, but I've never heard of any provision in which they did. And third, the university already houses a larger percentage of its people here than any other branch of the University of California does. And fourth, the city has now had, since the 1970s, to accommodate the fact that the university is here and simply refuses to do anything about it. Time after time after time, builders and planners have proposed dormitory-style or apartment-style developments, and they have been turned down in former years.
Proposed them to who, and who turned them down?
They've been turned down by the Planning Commission and or by the council because of massive neighborhood opposition.
We're talking about university proposed this? Or?
No, the developers have proposed them. For example, Maynard Manson proposed a dormitory-style SRO up on Cardiff Street and simply withdrew it because the same group who stopped the Safeway from being built there and who has stopped numerous other things threatened to sue the city and sue him if it was approved. And this has been going on now for some 30 years, is that neighborhood groups insist that somehow it's the university's responsibility to house 100% of its population.
Or at least 70%, as they promised.
Even that would be fine, but you must understand there's also tremendous environmental resistance up at the university to getting anything done. I mean, every single time the city announces it's going to build new housing, its environmental groups start up about how it's destroying this and destroying that and endangered wildflowers and... So, I personally don't think that the university is as much a culprit as the dynamic between the town and the university is. And personally, I think that the residents, especially the residents of the west side of the city, are as much, at least, to blame for the, or at least as much responsible for the impact the university has had on housing as the university itself. I mean, Robert, if the university were the problem, if the university were the one who were doing all this to the city, why is it that no other area in Santa Cruz that has a university is experiencing the same thing?
No other area in California, you mean?
No, there is no other city that's put up this kind of resistance, inviting a university, getting the tremendous cultural amenities that come with a university, getting a population that fundamentally subsidizes its entire bus and other alternative transportation systems, that has flooded its downtown businesses with low-wage employees and a constant labor source and increased tourism, and helped create at least half of the cultural institutions that bring tourism here, and yet refuses to house them. Yes, we'll take the Shakespeare Santa Cruz. Yes, we'll take the open studios. Yes, we'll take all of the non-profit businesses and low-profit businesses and collectively owned businesses that came out of USA Riptide, which was formed by the university, etc. But no, we won't house these people. That's an imposition.
Well, Paul, why don't we hang up on you briefly, get some answers. Are you able to hear us on your computer?
Yes, I am.
Then you can perhaps respond with some thoughts if other people choose to call in with some questions.
I sure will.
All right. We'll call back shortly.
It's a deal.
All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. So now is your chance, listeners out there, to call in and query Paul Wagner or present points of view that may not have been covered by him, or perhaps criticisms, thoughts, reflections, questions, you name it. 427-3772 is the number to call, 427-FRSC. I actually requested some specific folks listen in to give their thoughts and comments, but unfortunately we thought this was going to be earlier, around 10 or 10:30, and we are now at 15 to 12, so we may not get those callers. But if you are out there, why don't you give us a call? You've heard a number of we've been discussing ADUs, the impact of the university on housing, the housing element, and how the county has failed to meet its requirements in terms of density. Looks like we got a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Paul Marshall and Sampson. In hopes that people won't be tired of hearing from me, I just wanted to...
I'm tired already. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that Mr. Wagner has made some excellent comments about the university and about the need for more, I'd say, multifamily housing, whether you call it apartments or, it can be apartments, SROs, dormitories, all kinds of different things. But my partner and I live at... in one of Maynard Manson's projects, and we watched the banter in the newspapers about this project, and there were some problems with it. The city gave away some of the land, gave tax concessions. There were lots of issues like that I don't think we should be giving away things to developers. But there was tremendous opposition to the community, not over those things, but over the idea of having apartments. And our apartment building is basically townhomes. We have private patio space in the back. We have modern kitchens. We have safe wiring. We have bike racks. We're within walking distance of the farmer's market, the food bin, all of the, core Santa Cruz businesses that people would depend on here for this lifestyle in Santa Cruz. It's a great place to live. And the rent, I think, is reasonable compared to what I saw in San Francisco, compared to what I see for real slum-type apartments in some parts of the city. I think it's a relatively good deal.
What is the rent?
Our rent for a large one-bedroom apartment is $1,100. I know that that's not excellent. It's about right in line with the median rent for one bedroom in this county. But what was really disheartening is that somebody wrote into the Sentinel and said that this development was a slum.
Maybe it's because of all your bus riding activities. Why don't you get yourself a car?
I mean, that really got me that, housing for ordinary people was a slum. The development allows Section 8. A small number of the tenants are Section 8 tenants. It's 96 units, and I think 10 or so are set aside for low-income people who are not eligible for Section 8, but who are, just general people on low income. And, because it's a multifamily development, because there are a lot of students, families, et cetera, the public writes in and call for the slum. I don't know what to say.
Wow.
So that's Santa Cruz for you. That's all I'll say. I just really appreciate what I'm hearing here from Mr. Wagner. Some really good thoughts for people.
Hey, well, thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So phone lines are open, 427-3772. Phone line is open. Give a call in, and you can get a response, perhaps, from Paul Wagner on the Housing Advisory Committee, talking about the latest activities of the, well, I guess it's the city council, perhaps the board of supervisors. We haven't actually gone into the specifics of what has and hasn't been done. Perhaps Paul will do that when he comes back on after an interval. 427-3772. If you're out of the area, it's 831-427-3772. Well, I think we're going to do, while I wait for the flood of phone calls to come in, I'm going to give you a little of Mike True, who's a musician, who is one of the Street Performers Union folks that's just formed recently, but actually, let's do that after this phone call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Andrea at the Compassion Flower Inn.
Hey, Andrea.
I was just listening to Mr. Wagner's comments. I think they're very, very good comments. That seems to be very knowledgeable. But I just wanted to tell you a little bit about what we're going to be doing here on the 16th, eve of the inauguration of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yes.
And we're going to have a light up with Arnie night here at the Compassion Flower Inn.
Is this some sort of burning poor Arnie in effigy, or no?
No.
Toking with Arnie.
Actually, we're going to be showing the movie Pumping Iron.
Is this the unexpurgated version, which has him toking a joint?
Exactly, exactly. And so we want to send the message to Arnie that we want him to support medical marijuana patients' rights as well when he's in office.
Are you going to invite the Santa Cruz City Council to attend the same thing so they might be persuaded to actually change the zoning laws that would allow clubs to open up that have been forced to close?
Well, we want to do all of that. We should certainly do. We're inviting the City Council members, the mayor, Board of Supervisors. We invited Sam Farr, Bruce McPherson. We want them all to come.
I haven't received my invitation yet, Andrea. My gold-plated invitation has not arrived in the mail.
Well, you're invited as well, and I'm just calling you up to tell you that you were invited to the event.
Excellent. You know, I wonder if you can give us a quick update now that you're on the phone, although it's a little bit...
I know that it's in between here. You're talking to Mr. Wagner, and you weren't talking about the housing crisis, but...
No. I mean, I'm glad you're doing that, but I... Again, is this something the public is invited to as well?
Oh, it's just to the general public, yes.
And when and where is this again?
We're going to do it at the Compassion Flower Inn. It's good to come through the alleyway at Birch Lane, right across from the Poet and the Patriot. And we're going to have a suggested entry fee of about $5 in order to cover the cost of the music, the film, and we're going to have a few little refreshments there as well. And it's going to be 4:20. So the event's going to start at 4:20. We suggest that people arrive a little bit early, so that when the speakers start their talk, we've invited Ed Rosenthal, the father of medical marijuana.
Ed is the man who was prosecuted and then convicted in San Francisco for what? For being an authorized marijuana grower for the Oakland Cannabis Collective.
That's right. And in his trial, none of the testimony about him being a medical marijuana provider could be presented in court. And the jury had no other choice but to find him guilty. But then when they found out that he was growing for the medical marijuana clubs, seven of the 12 members publicly apologized of the jury to him for finding him guilty.
Right. So this is going to be 4:20, a little bit before, at the Compassion Flower Inn, which the address of the Compassion Flower Inn is...
216 Laurel, but we ask people to come through the Birch Lane side, which is the back of the inn. The event is actually going to occur in the parking lot, and we're going to project the film Pumping Iron up on the wall of the Poet and the Patriot. Chris
Will you
Matthews
be doing some Pumping Iron yourself, Andrea?
Well, we're going to have, some gym equipment here, if people want to try that out. We're going to also have a groping wall.
Wall. Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're going to have more or less a cardboard wall, and we're going to have holes, made for the arms and hands. We're going to have long latex gloves attached to the wall, and for the gropers, they can be on one side, and the gropees, people who want to be groped, can be on the other side. And
we also have
turns.
A wall for a special section for those who didn't swallow and who can define what is and that sort of thing.
Well, that's what we want to tell it the way it is, right?
Yeah. So this is at, again, on what date?
November the 16th, which is the eve of the inauguration. I think they plan on him being inaugurated on the 17th of November. So
that's
we're going to do it the day before. We want to send that message there to keep the feds out of the Compassion Gardens and to support legislation that's before the both the federal House of Representatives and the state in order to allow medical marijuana testimony and federal trials.
There was some bad legislation that recently passed in terms of quantities of marijuana allowed by each county.
Right.
You want to tell us what that happened there briefly?
Well, I hear you had Anita on your show earlier this week. Did you go over that at that time?
Anita did not make it to my show, and we're hoping she will. She had a conflict, so we're trying to get her to on the air. Anita, if you're listening, feel free to call in, but maybe you could do a kind of a pinch hit here. Or a grope hit.
Perhaps. SB 420 was passed by our outgoing governor about 3 weeks ago, and what that establishes is guidelines for the entire state.
Luffy. Which is actually, a loofy is less than it would cost to actually build a unit. So they don't have to actually build them when they build an apartment or a condo complex or whatever. And then we get stuck with places like Sycamore Commons and I can't remember the name of the other place down there at the end of Chestnut Street, Nerys Lagoon and stuff like that, which is, you know, against what it says in our housing element as to how low-income housing should be built. And it basically stigmatizes the people that live there, because once somebody knows you live there, oh, you're living in the low-income housing. You know, it's not like you're living on some other street somewhere else.
What's like the caller that called in and said that, you know, Paul Marshall and Sampson has said that he was really discouraged to see somebody wrote a letter about his about Maynard Manson places being considered a slum, and that's not even low-income housing, right?
Right. And, but it's, you know, right down the street from Nerys Lagoon, which is the low-income housing. And so, you know, the same council members that voted to put this element back into our housing element have repeatedly, over the years, voted for these giant projects. You know, I mean, it's just like what's happening right now down on the Beach Flats with this whole Dolphin Lee project, which I guess they've changed the name of because
Nueva Vista.
Right, because the Dolphin Lee took on this negative connotations because some people in the community decided to fight against it because it wasn't really going to house all the people that were already there. And so once they ramrodded it through, they decided to change the name so that, you know, when they talked about it in the future, people wouldn't associate it with the Dolphin Lee. But, you know, to me, you know, that's another part of this whole thing is that, you know, if you're really going to assimilate the poor people into our community, you don't stick them in housing projects. You disperse them up throughout the community in smaller clusters, and that way they don't get stigmatized, you know. Otherwise, everybody knows, oh, you live in a housing project. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about was ADUs or granny units. And the city has, you know, for years and years come up with different rules and regulations on, you know, how to convert a garage or whatever into an accessory dwelling unit. But, the, you know, and then last year they relaxed those rules because the state came up with new rules concerning that. And if the cities and counties didn't amend their own policies, and the state rules would automatically go into effect, which were much more liberal than what we had here in Santa Cruz. But the big problem, I mean, besides that the process is cumbersome and a lot of people don't want to pay the cost of even just going through the permit process, let alone actually doing the building, the big problem as I see it is that right now in Santa Cruz, you know, I'd say somewhere between 30% and 50% of the garages in Santa Cruz have already been converted illegally. The city council keeps on saying they're going to address that issue, but never has. They keep on saying, oh, it's too much of a boondoggle, you know, it's too controversial, whatever, you know. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, a number of people that I know personally have purchased houses recently where the garages were already converted. Now, if at some point in the future the city decides to clamp down on these things, that person is stuck paying all the fees or, you know, whatever associated with this unit, even though they didn't build it. They bought the house that way. And somehow the city has to address these already existing units. And a lot of the older homes in town, the garages are built on the property lines. And in the ADU ordinance we have here, you have to have so many feet between the property line and the unit. So if a garage that's already been converted is on the property line or too close to the property line, it can't be made legal under the current ordinance anyway, even if the owner of the property decided, oh, well, I just bought this property and I want to make this unit legal. They can say no because it's too close to the property line.
And that's also what Paul Wagner was claiming, that it's tenants and owners' reluctance to come forward that has made it difficult to amnesty these units. What's your reaction to that claim?
No, the city has never addressed this. The city, amnesty for any unit only applies if they're already in compliance with the law. Too many of them don't comply with the current zoning law that they passed. They're too close to the property line, or they're too close to the front house, you know, because there's all these restrictions on how close it can be to the front house. I think it's got to be 20 or 25 feet away from the front house. It's got to be, I think, 5 feet from the side property line and 3 feet from the back property line. And like I said, a lot of the older homes, the garages were built either right on the property line or a foot or two away from the property line. So any of those conversions, amnesty doesn't work for them. And, you know, that it's not a problem that people are reluctant to come forward and go for amnesty. The amnesty doesn't work for them. In order for amnesty to work, they have to say, okay, if the garage was legally built at the time period it was built on those property lines and the conversion happened, then we'll grandfather this unit as, you know, a non-complying unit that will still be complied.
Paul Wagner stated that Rotkin and Kennedy have not been the evil geniuses in this matter of opposing it, rather that they have been supportive of amnesties. What's your reaction to that?
They're not supporting giving blanket amnesty. They're only giving amnesty to units that comply with the ordinance as written. They are not willing to give amnesty to units that are too close to the property lines or too close to the main house.
So you wouldn't call them advocates of amnesty?
No. The amnesty, you know, what they have done is so weak that it's no wonder no one's come forward to take them up on the offer, you know. And then there's all these other fees that are attached to it. You know, you have to pay a sewer connection fee, you have to pay a water connection fee, you have to pay a school fee, you have to pay a park fee, and not to mention the planning fees. I mean, just the fees alone can make the project startup cost $20,000.
Did you look at the housing element that was recently passed by the, I guess it was passed by the city? And when I talked to activist Ed Davidson, who often comes to city council meeting and has commentary for the city council, he stated that it was a kind of a meaningless bit of housing element. It didn't have much relevance to anything and was kind of pointless. Have you reviewed it?
Well, I looked at it briefly, but I mean, basically what it is that, you know, every so often, every city and county has to update its housing element. And the city did it last year, and the state rejected it. And so they sent it back, and the city had to rewrite the parts the state didn't like. And now they're going to resubmit it. Hopefully it'll be accepted this, or they hope it'll be acceptable this time. Basically, yeah, it does nothing, you know, for poor people. Does nothing for homeless people. You know, it doesn't ease restrictions on already converted granny units, you know. I mean, basically, the granny unit part of the whole thing is just a rehash of the changes they made last year, which basically are not going to encourage anybody that has a pre-existing unit to try to comply.
Because what about the idea that if you build lots of, if you create a possibility where people can build new units, this will accustom the neighborhood to realizing that they don't have to worry and make it less controversial and painful for the city council to amnesty and grandfather in older units?
It'll make it less painful?
Well, it'll make it less painful if there's less protest.
Well, the fact of the matter is that, you know, there's not a big swell of people coming in saying I want to build a granny unit or that I want to legalize my existing granny unit. So until they change the law enough to make it so that people are willing to come in and legalize their units or to, you know, get the permits to do a conversion if their garage hasn't already been converted, until they change the law to make it easy enough for people to do that, to make homeowners willing to actually do that, it's not going to happen, you know. And the other problem with the law is that part of the law too is that the owner of the property has to live on the property. He doesn't have to live in the granny unit, but he has to live on the property. So a lot of the existing illegal conversions are on rental property, and the landlord may not even live in Santa Cruz, let alone not live on the property. So, you know, that's another part of this granny unit law that has to change if they're going to get a lot of people legalizing the already existing granny unit.
Well, Paul is one of 16 people on the task force doing this.
Yeah, I know. I've seen him on TV kissing ass to the council every time he goes up there.
Well, what do you think of the task force's activities? You're suggesting that they are a whitewashing group, or what's your thought on that?
Well, it's not that they're a whitewashing group. It's just that they don't have any real authority or any real power. They just like look over documents that staff prepares and, you know, may recommend changes in those documents. Now, whether or not the staff is willing to make any kind of the changes that citizens appointed to a commission make is, you know, very questionable in my mind.
Well, Scott, thank you. I'm going to try to get Paul to respond to a few of the things you said if he hasn't disappeared on us. Feel free to call in again and do some more dialoguing if you feel like it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
And Paul, if you're out there, Paul Wagner, give a call in at 427-3772. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert Bernard.
Aha, go ahead, Bernard.
I had one question, you know, I guess from Mr. Wagner.
Yes.
He talks about, you know, the city meeting the environmentalists, you know, really coming down on the city anytime the city, you know, starts to pick a spot, you know, for the location. Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
Well, why don't the environmentalists, why can't the environmentalists make a recommendation on for what spots it should be built?
Okay, I'll pass that question on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, jump in here quickly, or Paul, hopefully you can jump in here, 427-3772. Hi, it's Free Radio here.
I haven't disappeared.
Oh, good, good.
How you doing?
How's your cold?
It's slowly clearing up. I keep dosing myself with grape juice and vitamin C.
Okay, well, hey, stay with us. And, of course, you heard some pretty strong criticism from Scott Graham. What's your response?
Oh, boy, well, he said so many things. I need to give individual responses. Let's see. Every change, first of all, about the housing element process, every change that those of us on the committee and that people from specific advocacy communities wanted to make that actually had to do with housing were made. That's number one. Number two, let's see. The first thing Scott talked about, and Scott has a pretty good sense of the outcome of these things, I have to say. He's certainly, boy, if we housing advocates were dealing with people like Scott rather than some of the people we deal with, we'd be having a lot better time and we'd be getting a lot further. The first thing Scott said was, he rightly said that the proper way in order to integrate lower-income people in the community is not to put them into gigantic housing projects, but instead distribute that housing throughout the community. And he noted that we worked really hard to get that policy, which, as he also correctly said, had been part of the general plan for a long time, back into the housing element. Scott attributed the rise of this project mentality in Santa Cruz to the council. I think that's a misattribution. Robert, back throughout the 60s, 70s, and early to mid-80s, builders who constructed apartment buildings, no matter what size, got a tremendous tax credit for doing so. That's one reason there was so much apartment construction during that time. In the 1980s, in order to prove that they were not supporters of corporate welfare, Democrats in the Democratic-controlled Congress decided to get rid of that tax credit as part of what they called corporate welfare. Ronald Reagan and housing experts pleaded with them not to do it, and they did it anyway. The result of that is that apartment construction began to shut down because the startup costs of doing all the plumbing and electricity and, you know, those, it's a lot harder to build 100 apartments in the same size building than it is to build 2 or 3 condos. And so what happened was that those who build apartments and who build mini apartments and SROs began to turn to tax credit law. And under tax credit law, what happens is that private investors invest in things like Neary Lagoon, and they keep hands off unless the place starts to go into financial ruin, at which point they take over. But fundamentally, the only things that these large investors will back are large projects in which there's a constant rent flow, and the project is large enough that they can have an accountant who presents the reports to the investors on a quarterly basis. So the reason that the council has not approved 4, 8, and 16-unit projects that are guaranteed low income is because they haven't gotten any. This is one of the biggest things that has happened in subsidized low, very low, and extremely low-income housing over the last couple decades, is that they have all become larger projects. Because that's the only kind of structure under which the nonprofits like Mercy Housing can raise money. So when Scott says that this is the council's doing, he's just not correct. It's a national phenomenon. Are you there?
I'm here. What about the other criticisms?
Recite some things for me.
Well, see, he spoke about the failure of Kennedy and Rotkin and the council generally. I was using them as examples because they are sort of archetypal figures on the council.
Sure.
To seriously propose any real amnesty.
I would say that if one, yes, I would have to agree with him. I would have to agree with him. I think that there is a different reason for it than the one he's giving, but he's, of course, welcome to his own thoughts. I think that the council has revised the ADU ordinance so many times and made it so much looser that the time for when the public was calmed down enough to do amnesty has simply never come. I also, Scott also commented about how many of the units that possibly could be grandfathered, the illegal units, won't make it through the law. You and I have talked about that a number of times in the past. And he's right, there are a number of units that couldn't make it through. However, I believe from my own experience in having looked at 160 of these units, 161 actually, personally, that the changes that the council made in the law twice in the last couple of years probably lets through two-thirds or three-quarters of the units that are now illegal. The biggest change that the newest revision of the law makes is exactly the one Scott referred to, which is setbacks. The setbacks are now 3 feet rather than 5 feet. And that's a really big difference because we have three generations of building in Santa Cruz. We have the generation that was done back before there were any planning and zoning laws, when there was, as Scott pointed out, a zero setback, when you could build right on the lot line. And then there was the period through the whole mid-century where there were laws designed to let fundamentally emergency services through that demanded a 3-foot setback, and in which lot sizes were somewhere from 2,500 square feet up to, I think the standard was 4,800. And then there's the period, the more modern period, that started 3 decades ago, I believe, in which the standard lot size was made 5,000 square feet and the setbacks became 5 square feet. Well, the vast majority of those buildings were built, older buildings were built during the 3-foot setback time. And so by moving the setbacks of second units to 3 feet away from the property line rather than 5 feet from the property line, the vast majority of buildings built in the city of Santa Cruz are now eligible to apply for legalization. Also, by expanding the law so that any part of a building that is within the usual residential envelope, in other words, that has the usual standard front, back, and side yard setbacks, rather than having special provisions as to what parts of the lot can build on, let in more, and also the part of the law I'm getting rid of, the provisions that say that the granny unit or ADU or second unit has to be a certain number of feet from the main dwelling, which the council fundamentally got rid of, that lets even more. I would be surprised if at this point 3 out of every 4 illegal units could not be brought into conformity with the law after the changes that the council made. I also have to say that Scott said that the city loosened the law because the state required it to. That's not true. It did loosen one part of the law, which is the no public hearings, which some of the council had tried to pass the year before and were blocked in by several council members. But the changes that the council made this last year to the second unit ordinance go way, way, way beyond anything that the state required. They did it of their own volition and not because all these other changes and not because the state required it.
Wow. Well, interesting. Are you willing to pause briefly while Scott calls in and gives you his thoughts on that?
Oh, sure.
Anything more you want to add?
Anything more I want to add? Were there any other points Scott made that you'd like me to address?
He mentioned the inclusionary buyout, but he didn't go into it in detail. Maybe you should tell people what that is and whether that has changed at all.
Well, fundamentally, we have a requirement both in the county and in the city. They're slightly different, that anybody who develops has to set aside a certain percentage of their units to be guaranteed to be kept in their sales or their rent price. And developers are allowed to pay a fee instead. Scott said that fee is lower than the cost that it would than it costs to actually build those units. He's right; that cost ought to be raised, or the in lieu provision ought to be gotten rid of. One reason that it's very difficult to get rid of that in lieu fee, regardless of whether it represents real time costs or not, in the particular year in which people assess it, and again, he's right, it is too low, is that over and over again, when builders have sued because there's an inclusionary ordinance, when they've sued under in federal court under Fifth Amendment property taking, no taking of property without just compensation clause, the courts have found that those laws do not constitute property taking because there is a way out, namely to pay an in-lieu fee. And usually there's also a hardship clause, like if you have some, 75-year-old man who wants to build four apartments with the only savings he has, and the hardship clause helps too. But that combination of the hardship clause and or an in-lieu fee is what it is that has preserved these laws. In those places in which they don't have an alternative, those laws tend to get thrown out as property taking. So I know that a lot of housing advocates want the in-lieu fee structure gotten rid of. It's, however, unwise on a federal level because it leaves the law open to be overthrown and then you get nothing.
Okay, let's see if we can. Can you hang with us a little further and call back again?
Yes, I can.
How much time you got?
Okay.
You got a couple more minutes?
Yeah, I have an obligation at one, but these are really important issues. And so, and I also have a request for you and your listeners. So,
sure.
I'll turn my computer back on, I'll listen in, and when you finish getting whatever calls you get, I'll get back on the phone with you.
Sounds good.
Okay, Robert, thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Bye. And you are tuned to Free Radio at 96.3 FM, and here is a quickie response call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert.
Hey, Scott.
So I heard what Paul just said, and basically I don't think that I was wrong in saying that most of the changes the council made recently to the granny unit were directly related to the changes that were made on the state level. They had to make it, it wasn't just the no public hearing. The no public hearing only applies if a unit's going to totally conform. If there's anything that doesn't conform, then they have to still have a public hearing. But all the other changes that they made were mandated by the state. If they hadn't have made these changes, then state law would have been the law that they had to apply to granny units. And it's actually a much more liberal law than the law we have right now. One of the biggest differences in the state law than the law we have is that the owner of the property does not have to live on the property. And that's something that still exists in the law here, and is one of the big reasons why so many of the granny units that already exist in this town will never be brought into compliance is because the property owner does not live on the property. The other thing is that there still is in the current law a setback from the main house. You have to be, I believe it's 20 feet away, maybe 25 feet away from the main house. I don't know why Paul thinks that was stricken from the law, but it's still in there. Because I know somebody that's actually trying to go through the process right now of legalizing a granny unit, and their garage is only 10 feet away from the house, and the person they have helping them, a land use consultant, is saying, well, more than likely we can get the city council to go along with this since it's an already existing unit, but there is a possibility that they will say that no, this unit isn't in compliance, and it's too close to the house, or they may force the people to put a sprinkler system into the already existing unit because it is so close to the house. There's a number of, the council can't override that provision, but it's not, as Paul said, they did not strike this provision. That provision still exists. The other unit has to be so far away. And as far as the in-lieu fees that developers can pay, I think that what ought to be done with the in-lieu fees is the in-lieu fees ought to be increased so that the in-lieu fees actually will be double what it would cost to build the units. So if a developer wants to build a 20-unit apartment and he doesn't want to have four of the units be low income, then the price he has to pay is actually paying the city enough money to build 8 units somewhere else instead of only being able to build a half a unit somewhere else.
But wouldn't that mean not doubling, but
Well, it would be more than double. It would be more than doubling the existing in-lieu fee. The existing in-lieu fee is so low that you couldn't even build a half a unit with what the current in-lieu. I think the current in-lieu fee is like $40,000 per unit or something.
And is this something that the city council has been approached on by?
They've been mulling this over for years, and supposedly the Crone Sugar Fitzmaurice Council was going to do something like that, and somehow were talked out of it by staff.
Staff? You mean our old friend, city attorney, or I should say, city manager for life, Dick Wilson?
Right. That, you know, they decided, well, you know, if you do something like this, then building may come to a complete standstill in the city, which is absurd. You know, I mean, as long as rents are as high as they are in Santa Cruz, and as long as housing, buying a new house costs as much as it does in Santa Cruz, that's incentive right there for people to build. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, if you're building a brand new three-bedroom house and can turn around and sell it for $700,000, more than likely it's only going to cost you $200,000 to build the damn thing. So you're making $500,000 right there, you know. So what difference would it make, you know, if you're building 10 houses and so you have to pay the inclusionary unit cost on one of them? That's, you know, and you're making $500,000 on each house. That's nothing. You know, that's not a big chunk of your profits being taken away.
Do you see large money as playing an impact in this anywhere? I mean, there have been suggestions by some that there's been corruption on the city council around this issue. This is something I have not raised or discussed because I don't have any clear sense of it. What's your sense?
Well, I don't know if there's corruption on the city council. I think there's possibly certain elements within the city staff that are beholden to large developers like Barry Swenson and George Au and people like that, and are afraid to do anything to take one dime away from their profits.
Well, I hope you wouldn't include Charles Canfield of the Seaside Company in that group.
Well, Charlie, I don't think, is out there building housing. Although he owns most of the beach flats, he doesn't build houses. He just lets them deteriorate.
Ah, yes. Well,
to bring down property values so he can buy more of the surrounding houses.
That's a very cynical view of one of our most enterprising businessmen in town.
Well, I mean, I at one time knew somebody that actually worked for the Seaside Company doing maintenance on the houses down in Beach Flats that the Seaside Company owns, and they are under strict instructions, according to this person, to never do anything to improve the looks on the outside of the house. They can make improvements inside, but they could never make any improvements on the outside to make the outside look better.
Maybe they're just trying to maintain a kind of a folksy exterior.
No, they wanted to keep property values down so Canfield could continue to buy more and more houses. Now, another story about Canfield, which is sort of off the subject, is I know this guy that he told me recently he was doing some work for Charlie Canfield's daughter at her house. And unbeknownst to him, there's this woman that was there cleaning the bathroom, and the woman that was cleaning the bathroom kept on coming up to him and saying, well, why don't you do this way? Why don't you do this that way? And finally he got pissed off at her and said, listen, lady, you do your job and I'll do mine. Well, he found out the next day that was Charlie Canfield's wife, the mother of the woman he was working for, and he thought it was just the cleaning lady that was, you know, butting into his work constantly.
Yes. I see. Well, look, let's stay if you can listening to the radio. Let's see what Paul has to say about your latest response. He had one final thing that I want you to comment on, though, before you go. He stated that the majority of houses involved in terms of the setbacks were built in a period of time when the 3-foot setback was the rule, and therefore the changes made by the city council essentially exempted 3/4 of the houses.
Well, I don't think that's true, because most of the houses, see, Santa Cruz didn't have a building code codified until 1955. Most of the housing in Santa Cruz was built before 55. And even still, like I said, there still is this rule about how close the unit can be to the main house, and the other thing is that the property owner must live on the property, and that's another thing that, you know, makes it so that, like, he's saying, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 of the housing could be made legal. Well, if the landlord doesn't live on the property, it can't be made legal under the existing law here in the city. So, you know, maybe if you ignore that, a bunch of them could be made legal. But, you know, I don't agree with his numbers. You know, I think that there's, you know, and there's other things that have to happen. I mean, if somebody wants to legalize the unit, you know, it's not just that they get inspected for plumbing and wiring, but it also, they have to, the house has to be anchored to the ground for, you know, for earthquake safety. And a lot of the, you know, most of the old garages were not anchored in accordance with what the current law is on, you know, what the anchoring system should be. And so, you know, that's another major expense, and it's another thing that, you know, doesn't come into play until somebody tries to legalize a unit, and then all of a sudden they find out, oh, this house has to be anchored, and you know, that's a major expense, because you're talking about opening up walls in order to anchor the building, and
okay, well, let's see what Paul has to say about that.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye.
A lot, Scott. And lines are open. You can try to dash in before Paul gets to the phone, but hopefully Paul will be calling in shortly to give a few thoughts on that. And here's a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
You know, Robert, it's Ed. Finally got through.
Hey, Ed Davidson. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, well, I've been listening a lot, and the issues that I see are not so much the ADUs. It's negligible at best in terms of the housing production. And I don't want to referee the differences, but it is true that the majority of the existing ADUs are not legal, and getting them legal is going to be a problem if the city doesn't crack down on the illegal ones. Then you're going to have all hell break loose if they try to somehow force everybody to come into compliance with the law. So they've just sort of been quiet about it, and the chance of getting people to bring them into compliance have been stymied, because they do have to meet so many expenses that it's almost not practical to do it. So it's just going to sort of sit there as a problem, and hope that the ones that are underwired, particularly fire traps, don't start killing people because of you know, the safety laws that are you know, not being met in the uninspected units. So the council's aware that they would like to see things brought into compliance, but they know that they can't force the issue, because to say that's an important part of our affordable housing stock. So it's not going to change, and the change in the rules is not going to have a significant effect on the supply of housing.
Well, could the city council make the changes that Scott suggests, for example, allowing owners not living on the property, and then removing what he claims, and apparently what Paul disputes, is the requirement that there be a setback from the house?
I don't think the council's going to do it to require to allow absentee ownership of both units on the property.
Now, are you right in saying state law allows that for other places?
No, it's not really part of the state law. It's not in there either way. But the reality is that the biggest issue that the city can, I mean the council members confront, is that people who live in single family neighborhoods are not happy with their neighborhoods becoming essentially two family neighborhoods, which is what happened if they're all rental, if the owner isn't required to live on the property. It does change the way that property is managed when the owner is living there, and the appearance and the upkeep and the relationship to the other single family homeowners, some of whom now have invested, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if you will. They don't want to see their neighborhood become a low-income a rental neighborhood. And it's similar to that is the rental houses in the better single-family neighborhoods, the ones that are renters and they get, you know, four or five students cramming into these units, the owner-occupied units do have a neighborhood appearance and family value, if you will. I don't know what you want to call it, but, you know, if you have student housing, the lawn isn't kept up, the hours are different, partying, you name it, you know, extra cars parked all over the place. You can kind of walk through these neighborhoods and you can just look and see which ones are rental houses and which ones are not.
Did you hear Paul talk about the university and the fact that he didn't really blame the university for not meeting its share of the housing promises it made? What's your thought on that?
Well, the university is stuck because if you first realize that the property, the university itself is surrounded by open space on 270 degrees of the surrounding property is parks and Poganip and Gray Whale and you name it. It's all open space properties. And so the university can't even help private sector put any housing up there because that's all out of bounds. The only place they can build housing is essentially on campus. And the on campus, there's a separate university housing authority that builds the housing. It's not the regular region's budget. It's a special account that builds housing. And until recently, they could not, until the recent housing crunch starting 5 years ago, they were unable to fund any new housing on campus because the existing housing wasn't filled up. And that ended, of course, recently. But for a long time, they had no source of funds to build any new housing. Now they're building, and they will continue as long as the existing housing is filled up. They will have the chance to build more housing on campus.
Should we be annoyed with Rotkin, Kennedy, and other council members for not pushing for a strong amnesty sooner? Or not pushing for it tomorrow or yesterday, so to speak?
On the granny units?
Yeah.
I think that if they... it almost doesn't matter. That was the point I was trying to make. That if they do try to enforce the existing health and safety codes and forcing them to become legal, it's not going to happen. If you go after violations, current violations. So the alternative is to say, well, we'll give an amnesty, but when you give the amnesty, the people who are likely to, you know, who might want to, you know, bring it into code and so on, they're unlikely to want to pay the fees. There's an enormous fee base that you have to pay just to make the building legal.
What about grandfathering the stuff in?
And not having the improvements to make them safe?
Well, they're not about to make them now anyway, right?
Well, I'm saying that if there's an amnesty, it would be only on the illegality, you know, removing the illegalities, that is, they're uninspected and they're not necessarily built to code. And but they're still going to have to pay for getting inspectors out there, and they're going to pay for maybe have to pay for a new water meter, even though obviously they're on the existing water meter. Park fees, they're not going to waive the park fees, and that's $3 per square foot, and we're dealing with 500 square feet. That's $1,500 in park fees, that kind of thing.
Ed, thank you for calling in. Anything you want to conclude with? I want to catch Paul before he dashes off to his 1 o'clock appointment.
Okay, my cynicism over the whole housing element process—not the process, but the fact is that all the nice sounding paragraphs and chapters don't amount to a hill of beans because they don't follow the rules anyway once the element is built. And they just do whatever is available and possible, and they drag their feet on other things. So it's just it's a nice, pretty booklet that doesn't really do very much for the housing. That's my cynicism on it.
Thanks, Ed.
Okay, bye bye.
And Paul, if you're still there, now might be the time for you to call in and give a quick wrap up of your response to Ed and Scott's thoughts. You're tuned to Free Radio, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrob Spears Broadsides. We'll give Paul an opportunity to get to the phone and listen to a little of Mike True's Desperado Blues while we're waiting. Desperado Blues you ever heard. Hi, Paul.
How you doing, Robert?
Good.
So, the processes, and the pressure began to build to control some of this from a more central place to stop communities, for example, from incorporating and gobbling up everything around them, including farmland and desert, and just swallowing it all up with low-density housing, which is tremendously costly because you've got to run and maintain utility lines to all those places.